scholars claim. That perspective belongs to academia and those who support the system. But it has little to do with the practical realities of people's lives. Lawfare is a tool that I have also seen used by imperialism that targets social and political leaders who are striving for change. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. La forma de ejercer el poder, los estados.
The ways in which power is exercised by states have always been multifaceted. They utilize military, economic, and legal means. Sometimes military force is the primary method for addressing issues, while at other times, legal avenues are pursued. Currently, due to various contradictions, particularly the weakness of popular movements, it's not the military that is taking charge, but rather the so-called soft coups through legal warfare or lawfare, as it is known. To discuss this topic, we have a special guest from Argentina, Silvina Romano. She's a prominent researcher and academic, serving as the coordinator of the Lawfare Observatory, which focuses on the study and analysis of judicial warfare in Latin America. With a doctorate in political science, her research primarily examines the relationships between the United States and Latin America, along with issues related to democracy, security, and the use of legal strategies as political tools. Silvina Romano, welcome to Black and White.
Bienvenida, Silvina Romano, a Negro y Blanco.
Hola a todas y todos.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What characteristics has this hybrid legal war, known as lawfare, taken on, Silvina? It would be great if you could help us understand where the term comes from, especially in the context of Latin America. How does it manifest itself?
The
main point I want to make is about how the judiciary, particularly its supreme courts, shapes political dynamics. How does this happen? There are numerous legal actions taken against certain political sectors, leaders, and parties that have a chance of winning elections. By filing these lawsuits and bringing them to the media's attention, it creates a sort of spectacle around these legal accusations, effectively preventing these individuals and groups from participating in the electoral process. This is the general idea. Where does this concept originate? It seems to define the current situation. It's a term used in the United States, originally coined by an American military figure to describe how soft power tools, rather than force or weapons, can be employed to intimidate opponents and persuade them to withdraw from their struggles. One of the key tools in this context, known as lawfare, is particularly noteworthy. Economic sanctions play a significant role in shaping international relations. They can be used strategically to influence countries like Iran and Venezuela, and to severely impact economies such as Cuba's, ultimately aiming to undermine their sovereignty and force compliance. This is a broad overview of the situation. The focus here is on how the judicial system and media power are leveraged to marginalize certain political groups, effectively removing them from the political landscape. As a result, when you go to vote, your options are limited because these individuals may be facing legal issues, imprisonment, or preventive detention. Consequently, the judicial system, along with media and social networks, shapes the political agenda.
La agenda política.
¿A ti no te parece que también es un poco...
Don't you think that there are also some misconceptions among liberal sectors when a democratic struggle for workers' rights and social change begins? They often overlook the fact that the judiciary and courts are crucial pillars of the capitalist state, which in many Latin American countries are heavily influenced by U.S. imperialism. Additionally, these judges operate without any popular oversight. For instance, in Chile and likely in Argentina as well, judges have not been removed. Instead, they have been replaced using the same methods. And we still see the same courts that date back to the time of Pinochet's fascist military dictatorship.
It seems you've hit the nail on the head regarding the issue at hand. Among all branches of power, the judicial system is arguably the least democratic. Just think about it. Until about 10 or 15 years ago, how often did we discuss the judiciary? Not very much at all. Back then, it was largely unknown. Now, names like Sergio Moro ring a bell for many of us, especially since he gained notoriety for imprisoning Lula. In the last couple of decades, we've witnessed a significant rise in the visibility of the judicial system. We see them on TVs, we hear about them on the radio. Why is that? Because it is taking over the agenda. We are talking about a highly conservative right-wing judicial power, as you pointed out. Why? Because when it comes to these courts, there is no replacement. Why is there no replacement? Because the judicial systems often represent our oligarchies or privileged minorities. Becoming a Supreme Court judge isn't just about having a good law degree. It's more about families and a sort of corporate network that perpetuates itself within this power structure. They reproduce themselves. It's important to note that while the judiciary has always influenced government decisions, it didn't have the same level of visibility and presence that it does today. Take someone like Diana Salazar in Ecuador, for instance. She's in the news every day. Remember what I said about Sergio Moro? They become celebrities in the political arena. This shows how the media and the judiciary are increasingly intertwining with politics, leading to a distortion of what politics should be.
That's right, Silvina. We'll take a quick break and be back in just a moment. We're back here with Silvina Romano. Silvina, you were sharing some insights about the interplay between the dominant media outlets and the interests of big capital, which the states in Latin America are part of, essentially the owners of this big capital. You also mentioned the role of the media and the courts. There is an intriguing aspect to consider. The courts often present themselves to the public as neutral entities. They project a somewhat saintly image, suggesting they rise above politics and contradictions, solely focused on delivering justice. But what kind of justice is that? Are they truly neutral, or do they serve political interests? Who appoints the judges?
It's important to highlight that every branch of the state is inherently involved in politics. The state is fundamentally a political organization. So to claim that it is apolitical is quite a simplistic way to describe any governmental power. It simply doesn't hold up. What we should focus on is that these powers should not be tied to any specific political party. Ideally, they are meant to deliver justice impartially. But why is that the expectation? If we consider that these judicial elites represent a privileged minority, we must ask whose interests they truly serve. Are they representing the interests of the people? It's worth noting that much of the political persecution through the judicial system has been against progressive sectors. So what do we mean by progressivism? Governments or political sectors that advocate for state intervention in the economy aim to redistribute resources for the historically marginalized minority in Latin America, particularly during the 1980s. So what do these minorities represent? They don't represent or care about the everyday people. It's not a matter of being good or bad. It's about serving other interests. They cater to corporate agendas and belong to families that lead transnational lives, existing in a world far removed from that of ordinary citizens. They're not interested in judicial processes related to, let's say, battered homes, abandoned or battered children. No, that's not what motivates them. Well, what drives them then? Their focus is on supporting large corporations and, above all, hindering processes where the state is taking over. To what end? To define and redefine concepts like sovereignty, autonomy, and the redistribution of resources, particularly those that are strategic in nature. To what end? To define and redefine concepts like sovereignty, autonomy, and the redistribution of resources, particularly those that are strategic in nature. The judiciary is politicized, favoring a privileged minority. Okay, now here is the question. Where do our judges receive their training? I'm not sure if I should continue, but it's crucial because most of the training often comes from regional organizations like the OAS, Organization of American States, or they attend courses in the United States. It's not that these programs are inherently bad. It's just that they are the available options that can help advance one's career, and that's widely accepted. The real question is, why should the framework and action plans for our judicial systems, judges, and prosecutors come from the United States when the needs and history of our population are so different? Exactly, this seems to be one of the key issues worth discussing.
It's similar to the relationship that the armed forces of our countries have with them. The United States train military officers and also judges. Everything is interconnected, like a giant octopus with various arms. Look, López Obrador attempted some reforms within the constraints of liberalism, particularly in the judicial branch, which is a significant aspect. In Venezuela, at the local level, there is also a process for the direct election of judges, specifically at the parish level. However, in Mexico, the situation was more complex, with strong contradictions arising. The judicial branch strongly opposed these changes. What can you share about that effort to alter the nature of the system, even though the fundamental nature can't change without a shift in the overall system?
I believe it's positive on two fronts. One aspect is the democratization of the judiciary. And I find the experience unfolding in Mexico to be quite fascinating. Initially, the focus was on reducing the privileges of the court, which had exorbitant salaries and outrageous benefits in a society marked by significant inequality. I think they have rightly placed their attention on this issue, and it's a positive step forward. Now, the question is, what does this minority in the judiciary represent? We find ourselves in societies that are extremely unequal. If we don't address the structural inequalities, no matter how many reforms we implement in state powers, we will continue to sustain a privileged minority that survives inflation, neoliberal policies, and the selling off of nations. This group manages to survive. The issue with our judicial systems is that they perpetuate these structural inequalities. In other words, the privileged minority within the judiciary reflects these disparities. We can work towards democratizing this power by allowing people to vote for judges, but we must also change the underlying structural and economic conditions. There needs to be a shift in the relationship between the structure and those in power. How do we achieve this? It seems to me that this is somewhat what is being attempted in Mexico.
That's right. It's very hard for the people to have control over the courts if they don't have control over the entire state, given the very nature of a capitalist state. Can we say that lawfare also highlights the limitations of liberal democracy? It's definitely a topic worth discussing, isn't it? It seems like liberal democracy is often seen as a quick fix for everything.
Me parece súper interesante.
I find it incredibly interesting to focus on this issue because do you know who is revealing the limits of liberal democracy? It's the rising far-right movements that are coming to power through democratic means. This situation highlights the limits of liberal democracy. It pushes progressive sectors to define what democracy should truly encompass. Simply going to vote isn't enough. We need democracies that are substantive with economic, political, social, and cultural inclusion, elements that the far right in Argentina, especially influenced by Trump, are currently rejecting. The judiciary is one of the branches where these far-right groups stand firm, as they are part of the broader right-wing agenda. So I think the challenge today is to give substance, to give flesh to this democracy, and to recognize that what Latin America needs is social justice. Without social justice, it becomes challenging to discuss democracy in a meaningful or profound way.
That's right, we have elitist courts that obey the elite, and they see this as just. For them, it feels justifiable because they view our current situation, filled with inequalities, exploitation, discrimination, and widespread poverty across our continent, as normal. Which cases of lawfare have caught your attention the most in Latin America? One or two, perhaps?
Uno de ellos, o dos, no sé.
El de Ecuador. Me parece que el Ecuador.
The one in Ecuador. I think the one in Ecuador seems to be less visible compared to the Lava Jato scandal in Brazil, which received significant attention and is indeed important. The one in Ecuador in recent years has been a total persecution against Correism, against any political sector that doesn't kneel directly before the de facto power of the United States, which wants to make Ecuador one of the economic and military bases of operations in the region. What's happening is quite serious. The state is undergoing rapid deinstitutionalization. There's a scorched earth tactic at play, allowing cartels to operate freely, which creates a dire situation of poverty and makes it nearly impossible for young people to build a decent life. This has resulted in a wave of Ecuadorian migration as people are forced to leave their homeland due to a lack of dignified living conditions. The narrative justifying these actions has been framed as a fight against corruption. No, let's not be fooled. Corruption is a significant issue faced by governments around the globe. In Latin America, the real challenge lies in structural inequality, a lack of investment, and inadequate infrastructure. There are people living in conditions reminiscent of the 19th century, and while we will address corruption, we must also recognize that many children are going without a meal each day, thousands in our countries. We need to prioritize these issues as the left has always advocated, equality first, access to a decent life, and then we look at all the other issues, right?
Perhaps one example of what you're suggesting about Ecuador is the situation with the embassy. How did that go unnoticed and the courts remain silent? And now, in practice, the vice president's dismissal.
Absolutely. Take a look here. I'll also share the link to the book, Lawfare in Ecuador, War Against Democracy and Law. It details the case of Jorge Glass, who is recognized as a significant example of lawfare on an international scale. The Ecuadorian government disregarded legal boundaries and international diplomatic norms without hesitation. This sets a concerning precedent as it jeopardizes the right to asylum for everyone, which is extremely serious. And you know what happened? We're working to ensure this issue gains attention in international organizations and resonates widely. But Jorge Glass remains imprisoned, unjustly and illegally.
The camera is set aside, the courts are quiet, and everyone is in high spirits. Silvina Romano, we have reached the end, and we truly appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here on Black and White.
You're very welcome, and thank you. Let's keep fighting together.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. the limelight.
This so-called catch-and-revoke program in the United States of America, which uses artificial intelligence to deport international students that are deemed pro-Palestinian, sets a worrying precedent for freedom of speech in the U.S. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East iWrote, Axios reported recently, citing senior State Department officials of the United States, the Trump administration's plan to use artificial intelligence to deport international students that are deemed pro-Palestinian has received a wide range of reactions this week from across political spectrum, stirring fears of what this could mean for free speech in the U.S. The U.S. State Department reported plans to use artificial intelligence to revoke the visas of foreign students who are deemed pro-Hamas. The catch-and-revoke project, launched by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, according to Axios, will see AI-assisted reviews of tens of thousands of student visa holders' social media accounts and marks a dramatic escalation in the U.S. government's policing of foreign nationals' conduct and speech. Rubio took to X recently to announce measures against students, saying the U.S. has zero tolerance for foreign visitors who support terrorist violators of U.S. law. According to reports, the U.S. State Department has already revoked the visa of one unidentified student. The U.S. officials told Axios the reviews of social media accounts are particularly looking for evidence of alleged terrorist sympathies expressed after Al-Aqsa storm operation on October 7, 2023, on 1,000 occupied territories called Israel. Catch and revoke is one of the many escalations that have occurred this week in stifling momentum for the pro-Palestine student movement, in addition to President Donald Trump's cancellation of a $400 million grant to Columbia and the beginning of an investigation into the University of California over concerns surrounding anti-Semitism. Reactions to the announcement have received both criticism and praise, with many questions as to what this could mean for freedom of speech in general in the United States of America. In response to the announcement, many say that catch and revoke goes against U.S. law, and that internationals on student visas are protected by the First Amendment and they have the right to freedom of speech. Human rights organization Amnesty International USA posted on X, "Reminder, Mr. President, all people, regardless of immigration status, including students and faculty, have the right to peaceful assembly and freedom of expression, no matter the subject matter. If news reports are true, catch and revoke is an awful idea and an attack on human rights." Those that are in support of deporting international pro-Palestine student protesters argue that students that participated in encampments or sit-ins are not protected by the First Amendment. One person posted on X, "Free speech allows people to protest outside as long as they are not blocking or harming anyone. However, free speech does not include preventing others from learning or causing harm. Coming to this country to study is a privilege, not a right." Others who oppose catch and revoke have also pointed out that those who participate in pro-Palestine protests on campus, as well as the students who have vocally criticized the Zionist regime online, should not automatically be deemed as sympathizers to resistance movements. Palestinian-American academic Iman Abdullah Hadi took on X to call out those she believes gave the Trump administration permission to escalate the situation on pro-Palestine students to this extent. Everyone from Democrats to university admin who helped perpetuate the lie that critique or protest of Israel was inherently anti-Semitic or constituted harassment of Jewish students, you handed the university to the right on a golden platter. An anonymous user on X, who says they are an international student, says that the news of catch and revoke has made them even more fearful of protesting for Palestine. Another point of contention for many online is the government's use of artificial intelligence in identifying so-called pro-Palestinian students. The CIA-backed analytics firm being used for the subject, Palantir, is infamous for being used by the Zionist regime to facilitate its targeting of Palestinians and for its advanced capabilities in its war on Gaza. One person posted on X, "If you didn't know, Palantir is a company that generates kill lists for Palestinians in Gaza for the IDF. Now, this same kind of contact tracing tech is being employed in the United States for bad or for good. If they can use this AI to go after Hamas sympathizers, they can use this to go after any one of us at any time for any reason." Another echoed sentiment saying that catch and revoke is a beta test for US citizens. Those that voted for Trump have also expressed frustration with the administration for investing this much energy into censoring criticism of the fabricated regime of Israel. A person who voted for Trump posted on X, "Why are we protecting Israel so much even under our First Amendment rights of freedom of speech? I'm exhausted. I didn't vote for this. I voted for corruption, exposure, and transparency."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IranRadio.ir with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Shastavid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We have been discussing the major concept of taqlid in Islam based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei for several episodes now.
Yes.
And let's continue along this subject. And let me ask you at the beginning of this episode this question. And that is, you know, well, whenever we speak about taqlid, we mean follow a religious scholar.
Yeah.
Well, when we follow a religious scholar, one of the characteristics of this individual that we follow should be just, as they say.
Yeah.
Would you explain a little bit about this and elaborate on it, please?
Well, we do know that, first of all, a mujtahid should be male. Okay, some of the conditions or requirements of a mujtahid is that the mujtahid must be male. He must be baligh or mature. He must be Shia Ithna Ashari. He cannot be a Sunni, for example. He should be, of course, legitimate by birth, okay? Because, for example, someone who was born out of adultery cannot be a mujtahid. Even if he is a mujtahid, no one else can follow him. And then the last one, which is very important, is that the mujtahid should be, of course, just, okay? Adil, okay? Now, when it comes to the concept of adala, it is important because if the mujtahid is not just, he may be attributing false things to the Prophet and to the Imams and claiming things which cannot be trusted. So someone who is adil, he does not lie, actually. He does not fabricate things. He tries to be honest and to deal with his followers honestly, giving his fatwa based on his inferences from the Quran and the Sunnah. He does not amalgamate things with each other, with his own opinions, and then and then conveys his opinion to the people as those of God's opinion, or those of God, the prophets. So that's why it's important that the mujtahid be just, because he can be trusted, and people will rest assured that he is giving the religious actually opinion to his audience, and not those of himself, his own.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic we are delving into is still the concept of taqlid based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, one of the frequently mentioned or cited words in the area of jurisprudence is precaution or ihtiyat. Would you please elaborate on it for our DRI?
That's good. Ihtiyat is divided into wajib and mustahab, okay?
Yes.
And ihtiyat simply or literally means precaution. Some of the translators have used the word caution, but I think the word precaution is a better word to suggest that the mujtahid does not have a fatwa. He has not reached a conclusion, and therefore he is exercising precaution, ihtiyat, and he is advising his followers also to follow the same line of ihtiyat or precaution. So there are, sometimes he says, okay, alal ahwati wujuban, and alal ahwati wujuban is a term that denotes obligatory precaution. So obligatory precaution means that, okay, the mujtahid, that the precaution itself is wajib, okay? There is no fatwa, But that very precaution is necessary to follow. But sometimes ihtiyat is mustahab, and which means that, okay, the duty-bound person can choose not to follow this mustahab, precaution. He can follow another mujtahid. So generally speaking, when it comes to ihtiyat, of course, every duty-bound person is free to act according to that precaution or to follow another mujtahid. Another mujtahid, not every other mujtahid. Yes. There are many mujtahids who may not be qualified for taqlid. So when the mujtahid says that you can refer to another mujtahid, he means the next most learned mujtahid. Yes. So it's then becomes difficult for the duty-bound person who the next most learned mujtahid is.
So how can they understand it?
It's very difficult. When you ask the mujtahid himself, who is the next mujtahid, most learned mujtahid, he will not give you, he will not answer you, because he says it's not my duty to say who the next most learned mujtahid is. You have to ask, let's say, the fuqaha, the students of the Islamic seminary, and you have to go to the hawza to see who is reckoned to be the next most learned mujtahid. So it is the duty of the duty-bound person to identify the next most learned mujtahid. Generally speaking, these mujtahideen themselves do not announce such things.
So even if, as you mentioned, that if you refer, for example, to some seminary schools, Islamic schools, and you ask, for example, some of the scholars over there, and they will, or the clergies, they will tell you, for example, this one or that individual, and then they couldn't, reconcile them, for example, one single individual. So what would be the situation? How would you go about
if
it?
According to the scholars, if two witnesses testify that, okay, a certain mujtahid is the next, or he is the first mujtahid, okay, he is the most learned mujtahid, the most knowledgeable scholar, and then the next person who is the next most learned mujtahid is such and such person. Okay, if two just witnesses testify this, it is enough. It's not necessary to ask different people because there are maybe contradictions. Two individuals might consider a certain mujtahid as the next, and then there could be another person. So it's not necessary to put yourself into unnecessary trouble.
Okay. I see.
If two people who are students of the Islamic seminary and who are faqih, who have studied and who have close knowledge of that mujtahid, testify that he, for example, that mujtahid is the most learned or the next most learned, then that's enough.
And you don't need to trouble yourself for deep investigation.
Deep investigation.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the very subject of taqlid, and based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, we know that the duty bounds should follow a religious scholar.
Yes.
Or the most learned mujtahid, right?
Yeah.
Well, when it comes to that, sometimes you see that some duty bounds follow some dead religious scholars. Is there any problem with this if you follow dead religious scholars or deceased ones?
Well, it's not permissible according to the religious authorities and His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei to initiate taqlid of a dead mujtahid. Okay? By the word initiate, I mean that it's not permissible to start following a taqlid from the very beginning. Okay, you have now turned 15 years old, and you're looking for a mujtahid, and some people might suggest that you follow a dead mujtahid. Okay, you have no idea of because you are not very much, you know, rich in terms of your knowledge.
Yes.
So you might start, okay, following a dead mujtahid. That's not permissible. It's not permissible to start doing taqlid of a dead or a deceased mujtahid. Okay. Now, if you were following a deceased mujtahid, you're following a mujtahid,
yes,
but then that mujtahid died.
Died.
Of course, it's now your duty to see whether he is still the most learned mujtahid, or probably there is another mujtahid who is alive and he's better qualified, he is better eligible. Now, it is you again to look for that. If you think and if you come to some conclusion that the deceased mujtahid is still the most qualified, the most learned mujtahid,
mm-hmm,
then you should remain in taqlid of that mujtahid with the permission of a living mujtahid. Okay?
Yes.
You should go to him and ask his permission. Okay, if he gives a general ijaza or permission to his followers, telling them that, okay, to the mu'mineen, telling them to remain in taqlid of that mujtahid, then they can remain. Okay?
Mm.
It's not necessary for every individual to go to that mujtahid and and seek ijazah or permission in person. Okay,
yes.
And that's not sometimes possible.
Okay.
So then I forgot to mention there was another thing I forgot.
Okay, but well, let me ask you this question here, just to squeeze in because we don't have much time till the end of the program.
Yes.
And that is, you said initially you cannot follow a deceased mujtahid, right?
Yes.
Or a religious or a scholar. But what about the other ways that it is possible actually to follow a deceased mujtahid or a religious scholar?
Okay, if you are already following him, then you can remain.
That's the only way?
In taqlid of him. You, of course, that's the only way, of course. And you will need to get the permission of a living mujtahid.
Uh-huh.
And when it comes to some new issues, okay?
Yes.
Because the dead mujtahid might not have a fatwa about the current legal situation.
Yes.
Okay? And when there is no fatwa and you do not cannot find his opinion about that particular issue, then it's necessary to follow another living mujtahid in that regard, okay?
I see.
And that living mujtahid must be the most knowledgeable of all the living mujtahids.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IranRadio.ir. With me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير
Spring of Souls. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. The 13th day of the Iranian month of Farvardin, April 2nd, has been dubbed as the Day of Nature in the Iranian calendar. Iranians celebrate this day with going outdoors and spending the day in gardens, mountain sites, and riverbanks. It is the last day of Nowruz and is called Sizde Bedar. Stay tuned for the third and last part of the three-part program, Spring of Souls. Thank you. Sufis Devedar is an ancient feast and a good opportunity to make close bond with nature and appreciate this precious divine bounty. Iranians enjoy themselves on this day alongside their families and friends. Ancient Iranians used to celebrate the first 12 days of the year in remembrance of the 12th month of the year and finished it with the 13th day in nature. This was, in fact, the beginning of the first half of the agricultural year. Children are very happy on this day as they have the chance to run and play here, free from the confinement of tiny apartments of the modern life. Kebab and chicken are among the popular foods on this day, but other foods are also prepared for the event. Ash is among the foods which is usually found on this day. It is a special kind of broth which is made with vegetables and a special type of noodles or other ingredients. Kuku sabzi is also popular among Iranian families. This food is made with fried vegetables and eggs. However, Sizdebedar is not limited to foods. People, especially young ones and adolescents, spend part of their time in games such as volleyball, badminton, and national and local games. Moreover, in many regions of the country, families and friends converge to prepare ash together. This food is made in a large pot. Collective games are also common among Iranians on the 13th of Farvardin. Some of them are local ones like Haft Sang, meaning seven stones, while others are globally played games like volleyball. Dear listeners, people in other countries such as Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, India, and Pakistan also go to the nature on the 13th of Farvardin. They have ceremonies like Iranians. In Tajikistan, whose culture is close with that of Iran, Nowruz ceremonies continue till the 13th day. The Tajik people spend their day in nature and prepare traditional foods and play local games. Although this day has no specific name in Tajikistan, the people in this country have customs similar to Iranians. In Azerbaijan, too, Nowruz traditions are like those of Iran, but there is no specific ceremony like Sizdebedar of Iran. However, people go to the nature in the days after Nowruz. In the north of India and in Pakistan, there are traditions similar to Iran as a result of the impact of the Iranian Sizdebedar. People go to the nature, but this day has not been officially registered in their calendar. Sizdebedar is an opportunity for being with each other and entertaining beside one another. It is the time to appreciate the beauties of nature and be thankful of God for granting us infinite blessings. Sizdebedar reminds us that life is short and transient. It teaches us to respect nature and coexist with it kindly and attentively. It warns us that the health of nature results in our health. On the contrary, if nature is sick, we will be sick. Nature belongs not only to us, but to the next generations. So, it is a crime to break a twig or burn a tree. It would be irreparable to ruin a bird's nest or an animal's burrow. Sizdebedar can teach us that nature is a divine trust and we should deliver it to our children and grandchildren. Our happiness depends on the happiness of nature. Today is the day to renew your pledge with nature. It is the day to learn from nature, to be kind and generous to others. Sizde Pedar, the day of nature, is the time to teach the younger ones to protect the nature and not let anyone destroy its beauties or be heedless of its bounties. In short, today is the day to feel responsible towards nature and deem it a sacred creature.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel plans to expand ground offensive in Gaza as the regime's relentless strikes kill more Palestinian civilians in the blockaded strip. Israeli forces and settlers carry out new violent raids in the occupied West Bank, killing and injuring a number of Palestinians. And finally, China conducts a second day of military drills around Taiwan to warn Taipei against pursuing independence. Welcome to World News. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. Palestinians across the besieged Gaza Strip have endured yet another day of carnage as Israeli strikes continue unabated, claiming more civilian lives.